Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
It's Tuesday, December 18th, 2018, and this is Valley Edition. Today on FM89's Weekly News and Culture Magazine, we're going to spend the hour talking trash. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. On today's show, we look at creative ways to tackle waste, from what happens to used x-ray machines to a city that pays the homeless to clean up neighborhoods.
But let's begin in Fresno, at a secondhand business that is unlike most other thrift stores in the Valley. We'll take you now from the donated mounds of stuff that come out of people's packed homes to the recycling warehouse that sorts it all out.
Garbage trucks. Garbage trucks. Driving through the town, picking cans up off the ground. Garbage trucks.
Neighborhood Industries is a social enterprise. It takes a market-driven approach to business coupled with a nonprofit mission to care for the environment and help people in need. And it all starts with too much stuff. The company will pick up your used clothes, stained t-shirts, old rags, ripped jeans, electronics, broken vacuum cleaners, random wires.
We have routes that service Fresno specifically, but we also service about 320 to 330 donation bins between Bakersfield, Sacramento.
Donation bins along the entire length of the San Joaquin Valley, says CEO Anthony Armour. Trucks even pick up things that other thrift stores can't sell. And what makes Neighborhood Industries unique is very little of the secondhand material ends up in a landfill.
And we try to keep our waste under 5%. You know, that's just garbage. That's the stuff we can't do anything with it.
So where does it all go? Some of it is sold at the neighborhood thrift store in the Tower District.
It's $6.74.
And the rest? Well, it ends up in a vast warehouse just south of Roding Park in Fresno. On this chilly morning, Aaron Arnold is baling clothes like a farmer bales hay. But instead of a pitchfork, he empties trash bags full of shirts, pants, and dresses into a vertical baling press that smashes them down into a huge, colorful cube.
Wiring the bale down so the clothes don't go everywhere.
He turns on the machine and the intact bale drops out. Next, a forklift grabs it and adds it to the rows upon rows of bales waiting to be picked up by a truck. The bales typically go to grading houses in places like Oregon or even Ontario, Canada. Grading houses take a more detailed inventory of the clothes, evaluating them piece by piece. Some of it then goes to vintage buyers or even second-hand stores, both domestically and abroad. The stuff that is too damaged to sell is shredded and turned into carpet padding or fiber for insulation.
It's all just jobs that are created and sustained by collecting and processing these clothes.
That's Director of Development Ricky Bravo. He says the point of all this stuff is jobs. Neighborhood Industries hires people who have had major barriers to getting work. Maybe they can't read or they lost their driver's license because of unpaid traffic tickets. That was Aaron Arnold's situation, and he couldn't afford to get a new license because he owed child support. He was out of work for a long time, but then he says he got lucky.
Most of the welfare workplaces don't have programs like this. So they paid a couple payments of child support. They've gave me money towards PG&E for a month, have helped out in a lot of different ways.
Just to kind of get you on your feet?
Yes, ma'am.
Revenue from the thrift store and the recycling warehouse pays for a full-time social worker who figures out what employees need to stabilize their lives and keep their jobs. It might be literacy classes or getting a GED. For Arnold, the job of baling clothes has been life-changing.
I don't have to look at my kids like, Daddy can't do it because of his own mistakes.
But it's not just clothes that provide jobs.
Number three wires, adapters, mix boards, computer cutoff ends, steel, clean aluminum, dirty aluminum.
Chu Yang works on the other side of the warehouse, where giant cardboard boxes are labeled with spray-painted signs, flat screens, motor breakage. Yang untangles wires from metal pots and other stuff that looks like junk.
And some of these like metal stuff here, I'll test it out, see what kind of metal it is. Kind of, I have a magnet here to test. This is stainless steel, and I have a little bin here. That's where I toss them.
All of these things are sold to brokers who specialize in recycling metal, or transformers, or number three wires.
Yeah, so I'll go take care of it here at the cash register. And,
okay.
Yeah, no, this is a...
And now, Neighborhood Industries is growing its enterprise with a new pop-up store in downtown Fresno. It sells used higher-end fashion at higher prices, all in the name of more jobs. At a recent Art Hop, customer Lorraine Cepeda dropped in. She found a San Francisco Giants bomber jacket.
Pinstripe down the arm. It's light enough for a day game, but you could still use it for a cold night with a scarf and a beanie.
A scarf and a beanie that she might be able to find next time she shops here. You're listening to Valley Edition's special episode on trash. I'm Alice Daniel.
As my co-host Alice Daniel just demonstrated, the concept of waste is negotiable, even when it comes to one particular industry whose waste most of us would likely never think of reusing. I spent time with an organization in Clovis that sends a special and vital kind of used equipment overseas. In a loading dock in northeast Fresno, two men pull up to a warehouse, St. Agnes Medical Center, in a white moving van.
Go on around? Okay.
There, they meet a contract coordinator with the hospital named Heather Ritter. She pulls out a clipboard and asks them to sign a form.
As is, no warranty, no service.
As is, no warranty, no service, yep.
And no charge, how's that?
No charge.
They load the truck with medical odds and ends St. Agnes no longer has any use for. Surgical masks, metal shelves, and a device the size of a toaster with a multitude of tiny joysticks.
They call it an easy spray or fibrinofen.
I've never heard of the word fibrino, but I guess we'll figure that out.
St. Agnes is getting rid of the surgical equipment, not because it's expired or broken, but because the hospital has newer models. In fact, medical equipment in America is dumped at alarming rates because of upgrades, new hospital contracts, or even doctors retiring.
And everything that we're giving you is still operational, should still be operational.
And these men, Ken Allen and Jay Witters, are here to take the leftovers. They're volunteers with Medical Ministries International, or MMI, a nonprofit organization that donates used medical equipment to hospitals and clinics around the world. The need is real. Approximately 40% of medical equipment in developing countries is estimated out of service. Ritter says she's glad St. Agnes can help underserved communities.
It's really been wonderful for us because we don't want to see this stuff in the landfill, and we know it can still be used.
Every year, MMI collects hundreds of tons of medical supplies and equipment from hospitals and doctor's offices across the San Joaquin Valley. And all of it ends up in a small building near downtown Clovis. About a dozen volunteers stand along banquet tables stacked high with latex gloves, intubation tubes, and suture kits.
So this is a sorting warehouse.
Thomas Stokel is a board member and co-founder of MMI. At this warehouse, he and his volunteers test, sort, and pack medical supplies into shipping containers they send to clinics in two dozen countries. Stokel founded the organization in 1998 with his wife, Nancy. They're both nurses. He says they were drawn to this work after visiting a drastically underserved hospital in Lithuania.
As you walk into the hospital, they had strings attached to the walls, and the purpose of those strings was to hang their gloves because they reused their gloves because they didn't have gloves.
Over 20 years, Stokel estimates MMI has sent roughly 80 shipping containers around the world, each weighing 10 to 15 tons, and each worth as much as $500,000. MMI doesn't take used needles or gloves that can't easily be sterilized, but equipment like x-ray machines, hospital beds, and IV racks, Stokel explains they're totally usable, as long as they're not expired.
So it gives us an opportunity to stop that flow, direct flow to landfill.
The organization is faith-based, rooted in Christianity. Prayers and psalms are posted on its walls. Stokel says the organization serves everyone, regardless of their faith, But MMI does run mission trips abroad, and Stokel says they've been invited to build churches in some of the communities they serve.
What we do is reach out to help others and to just love on them and to have them see, hopefully, the love of Christ through the whole thing.
MMI is small, with only 3 paid employees, but dozens of similar organizations operate all around the world. Why so many? Because healthcare is inherently wasteful, even when you account for the good reasons, like hygiene and sterility. One study estimates U.S. operating rooms waste 2,000 tons of unused supplies like gloves, drill bits, and surgery kits every day. For one operating room at UC San Francisco, that works out to an annual loss of $2.9 million.
There's laws, and surely they were put in place for a reason, but I think the end result is there's quite a lot that's recycled or thrown away out of hospitals.
Andrew McCullough is with Direct Relief, a charity that donates millions each year in medical supplies and prescriptions abroad. According to the World Health Organization, as much as 80% of healthcare equipment around the world is only made possible because of donations. But McCullough warns donations need to be responsible. Good intentions go only so far. He's seen expired food and broken medical equipment dropped into disaster areas, unsolicited and unapproved.
If you're sending the wrong thing, it clogs up the supply channels, it clogs up the airport. It's actually more harmful. And then they're discouraged from ever wanting to receive anything again.
This is IV supplies.
Tom Stokel says Medical Ministries International takes great pains to not just helicopter into communities abroad. He says they test all their equipment. They familiarize themselves with local facilities and get pre-approval of everything they plan to ship. And they send sterilizing equipment and generators as often as they can.
We're not sending junk overseas. We want to make sure that everything we send overseas is usable.
MMI's next containers are going to the Philippines and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. They call them shipments of love. You're listening to a special Valley Edition. We're looking at society and waste. I'm Carrie Klein.
We've talked about recycling old clothes and medical equipment, but what about the basics you put in your blue bin? Cardboard, paper, glass. FM89's Laura Sitsui brings us this story from a Bakersfield recycling facility whose mission is all about the labor force.
That's the sound of the Bakersfield ARC's recycling facility. It's where about half of the city's recycling is sorted by material.
On a daily average, we do anywhere from 28 to 35 tons a day. So we're doing a good chunk of the city's material.
Andres Lopez is the recycling division manager here at Bakersfield ARC.
And then it gets put on here, and then that piece of machinery right there is called a loader. Puts it onto that conveyor belt, and then it goes up where we're about to go right now.
We're standing in a warehouse where, just outside, the contents from about half of the city's blue bins have been dumped. A conveyor belt brings the recyclables inside and up to a second floor platform. Workers stand along the conveyor belt, sorting items out by material.
And every single person has a specific material that they're trying to capture. The first chute is trash, the second chute is the cardboard, and so on and so on.
Back on the ground floor, Jeffrey Popkin, who's also with Bakersfield ARC, explains who else works there.
Now, on that line that you were just on, there are 3 developmentally disabled individuals to 1 staff person.
The Bakersfield ARC, or BARC, isn't just a recycling facility. It's a nonprofit that assists, employs, and educates adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities.
And part of the training that they're receiving is on employment skills, staying on task, working with the meeting production levels, showing up to work every day on time.
ARC used to stand for Association for Retarded Citizens, but the word retard is now considered a slur. So the group and its national organization kept the acronym ARC as a name instead. Their employees, also called clients, have intellectual or developmental disabilities, which might mean a diagnosis of Down syndrome, autism, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, or something else that affects their ability to work. Lisa Ackling is one client who's been with BARC for 35 years.
Oh, I have many jobs. First of all, I work here 3 days a week, Fridays, Mondays, and Tuesdays. 2 days a week through the same company here at BARC, I work at IKEA, putting up boxes on a conveyor belt.
On days when Ackling works at the BARC campus, her tasks vary, but she doesn't mind.
There's nothing I don't like. The only thing that, you know, I can't do, well, I can do it, if I have to, is janitorial work and, like, yard work and stuff because of my allergies.
Part of how BARC does business is through a certification from the Department of Labor to pay employees by their productivity, which means clients may or may not work at minimum wage. BARC CEO Jim Baldwin explains that this happens through a provision in the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act.
If somebody can do 50% of a non-disabled person, then you'd have two of them. That equals a whole job. Corporate America and mom and pop America can hire that and pay two different people to do well.
While this practice is legal, some disability advocates say that it isn't fair to pay employees with disabilities less than anyone else. Connie Chu is with Disability Rights California. She isn't familiar specifically with BARC, but she says the overall concern is that facilities exclusively employing workers with disabilities can be exploitative.
You know, for those of us who don't have disabilities that impact our work, we know that day to day, you know, our productivity really may depend on our energy level, how we're feeling that day, did we get enough rest, you know, are we sick, and other things.
Chu adds that sometimes facilities employing people with disabilities segregate them from employees without disabilities, creating a sheltered workshop.
Doing the types of tasks that are often happening in a sheltered workshop doesn't prepare a person to work in a competitive workplace.
But BARC CEO Jim Baldwin says they are preparing their clients by giving them options outside their recycling facility and helping them find the best job fit. Like Lisa Ackling, who says the job has given her independence. She has money to spend on movie outings and travel. She also pays her own rent and manages her own money.
I've lived independently on my own for almost 11 years now. Yeah, it's, you know, I have a little apartment. I keep it up and stuff. I'm real happy about it.
Happy enough to keep working at BARC, at least for the time being. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui. Now, we'll turn to the city that leads the state in waste management. In fact, San Francisco has a goal to send nothing to the landfill by 2020. But is this even possible? FM89's Monica Velez spoke with the city's zero waste program manager, Robert Haley. He starts by explaining what exactly zero waste means and whether San Francisco is on track to meet its goal.
Zero waste is often oversimplified, people, to mean just nothing going to landfill. But it's actually a lot more than that. Zero waste is really about eliminating not just downstream waste, say from the consumer, but also upstream waste before the producers, after the producers of products. It kind of gets back to that simple hierarchy a lot of us learned in school: reduce, reuse, then recycle or compost. So really it's about minimizing waste in the first place, really maximizing the value of resources, conserving resources, achieving highest and best use of resources, and then really not having anything go to not just landfills, but not to incineration either.
And how is San Francisco going to make that possible, being zero waste by 2020?
Well, we adopted that goal about 15 years ago. When we adopted it, it was always known to be a very aspirational goal. It's really about aiming for the ideal. We didn't want to aim for, you know, some amount of waste. No waste is good. So we really felt that it would create a sense of urgency by setting a date that was within our lifetimes. It would really drive a lot of action, and it really did. We have a lot of serious environmental issues, and we saw those issues 20 years ago. We really need to drive as much action as we can. We have recently at the Global Climate Action Summit that was held here in San Francisco in September. Governor Jerry Brown organized that big summit with about 5,000 world leaders. We kind of adjusted our zero waste goal. Our mayor, London Breed, announced two pledges. One would be to cut our disposal in half by 50%. So that was giving us a little more time on the concept of nothing going to landfill or incineration. This is by 2030. But more importantly, setting a second pledge of reducing generation by 15%. So that was really getting back to the top of the hierarchy, reducing and reusing waste, really reducing waste at the source. And again, that was by 2030. So we now have two goals that relate to zero waste, reducing generation by 15% and cutting disposal in half by 2030. Those are still extremely ambitious. Especially the first one, reducing the generation.
Yeah, and when you say reducing generation, what do you mean by that?
So what it really means is not producing the waste in the first place. So when people say reduce, they mean things like not buying wasteful products. You know, there's some really simple examples in our life, like not printing something if you don't need to, not buying too much food, not letting it sit around and rot in your refrigerator. So it's about reducing waste so that you don't even need to recycle or compost it.
What is Recology and how have they been helping San Francisco get to the zero waste goal?
Recology is our primary refuse service provider. We have a permit system in San Francisco that provides for the collection, disposal, and processing of refuse. And when I say refuse, it means recyclables, compostables, and trash that would go to landfill. So Recology has those permits. They have been in San Francisco for decades, for generations. The company's name has changed a little bit over time, and they've really changed their philosophy. Way back when they were a good recycling company, they made their money by scavenging materials. They would pick up material and try to recycle as much paper, rags, food for pigs. That's how they kind of made the business work. But like most of the refuse companies around the U.S., as we hit, after World War II, it started becoming more and more about landfilling and efficiency of packer trucks. But then after the 60s into the 70s and more recently, they've really become first and foremost a recycling and composting company. So they are as committed as we are to trying to landfill as little material as possible, try to recycle and compost as much as possible. And they collect from everyone in San Francisco.
And what are some different things that residents and businesses had to do to kind of, you know, go in this direction of zero waste? Are there any like different regulations that people in San Francisco have to follow versus like other cities in the state?
Yeah, there are. I would say we did it through, first of all, setting a goal of zero waste. And then secondly, putting together a lot of convenient programs with Recology, like our recycling and composting program. You know, we did the first food scrap composting pretty much in the country in a big city. And we did some of the earliest commingled recycling, really comprehensive recycling. Then we made recycling and composting mandatory for everyone in San Francisco. So this was the Board of Supervisors, and actually it was led by Mayor Gavin Newsom, who will soon be our governor here in California. So he's very committed to zero waste. Bottom line is he proposed this, our Board of Supervisors passed it, he signed it. So it became the law in San Francisco, you have to recycle and compost. We also have a lot of rate mechanisms. You basically save money if you recycle and compost. You get discounts for recycling and composting. If your materials are contaminated, we take away your discounts. If you have too much recyclables, compostables in your trash, we actually add additional charges. Recology works with us on that. And we can fine people and enforce laws too if we need to, but we try to not go that far if we don't have to.
And how do you think a smaller city with a smaller budget will be able to head towards going zero waste or making progress to maybe, you know, get there sometime?
You know, in some ways, it's easier in a small town. You know, the scale is very manageable. You know, when I look at a really small town, I think, well, that's like one route for us. That's pretty manageable. The challenge for small towns is that they often have very small government staff. And so whereas we have, you know, 11 of us here working on zero waste in my department, plus some outreach people, plus some people working to reduce toxics, it might just be a fraction of somebody's job in a small town. So it's hard for them to really focus on it or be an expert on it. The other challenge is they may not have the economies of scale that help. They may not be able to build the big facilities that we can afford. They may not be able to get a really long-term arrangement with a good service provider like we can. But generally speaking, small towns can do pretty well if they are committed to it. If one person in the government or one resident or one business person is committed to making it happen in that town, they can drive it. I think one of the things interesting about Fresno is there's just so much agricultural activity there. And I think that it's really a place where there's a lot of potential for even more composting. Fresno is really well situated to have an even closer food loop than we have, where your food is coming from nearby and your food scraps are going back to farms nearby. I think that's a really great thing for Fresno to focus on more, because food waste is incredibly impactful on our climate. It turns out that when you put food into a landfill, it creates methane, which is much more potent than CO2 as far as changing the climate. And secondly, if you compost it instead, and you put that compost on the right kind of land, it actually reinvigorates the soil and pulls carbon out of the atmosphere into the future. So it's like a win-win. And I just think that Fresno could really be a model of that, and it would be a great climate benefit.
Again, we are talking to Robert Haley, who is a zero waste program manager for the City of San Francisco's Department of the Environment. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me, and have great holidays.
Recycling the right materials isn't just a local issue. It's international. China has historically been one of the U.S.'s top buyers of recyclables, but for over a year, it's been putting restrictions on what it will import. My co-host, Carrie Klein, has been reporting on this situation. Carrie, what's been the fallout so far?
Well, it's led cities and recyclers to basically scramble to find markets for their recyclables. Some have launched outreach campaigns to change recycling habits. Some are raising rates for waste management, and others are simply stockpiling their recyclables until they can find buyers.
And it sounds like the city of Bakersfield is doing something kind of novel.
That's right. They're combining some of their recycling with a greener kind of waste. I spoke about it with Kevin Barnes, solid waste director with Bakersfield's Department of Public Works. He began by updating me on what China will no longer take.
Mixed paper is a really big item in California or U.S. recycling. That's not accepted there. Most of the plastics, number 3 through 7, there are some number 1 and number 2 plastics still being accepted, is what I hear.
And what is mixed paper? I mean, are we talking cardboard or newspaper or printer paper?
Mixed paper is everything from junk mail to magazines to mailing inserts, office papers that aren't really nice, clean, white paper. And that makes up a huge amount of the paper fiber that's recycled in the U.S.
And so what has all this meant for recyclers across California?
It means that the material recovery facilities, MRF, that's pronounced MRF, it's not Smurf, even though it's from little blue carts usually, those MRFs that sort and bale all of California's recycling are really having a hard time locating other markets to send to in the first place. So the few markets that they do hunt up can be very, very picky and pick only the best. So most of the MRFs in California have had to add more workers, more labor, more shift. They've had to slow down their equipment that helps sort the material so they can do a cleaner and cleaner job to perfect each grade so it can compete in the remaining market. And that translates into a lot of new costs for those MRFs. And we're typically seeing that passed on to the recycling companies and services that pick up recyclables.
And is Bakersfield considering increasing utilities rates in order to pay for some of this?
Well, we'll use a word other than utility rate. We'll call it the refuse service fee, separate from a utility bill. But yes, it's possible that we may have to adjust for that. In Bakersfield alone, we're nearly $1 million per year impact from the loss of where we used to get paid for material versus what we're now paying the MRFs for to take it off our hands. That translates into higher costs. So we're end up paying them instead of them paying us now. We're weathering the storm this year in Bakersfield. We're able to absorb it. We have a very healthy refuse and recycling enterprise, but it will have to be reckoned with at some point in the future.
And so you were describing to me earlier that the city of Bakersfield has, in order to deal with it, has implemented its own relatively novel approach to, you know, reducing how much of this will have to go to the landfill, and that's by turning some of this into compost. So tell me about how that works.
Yeah, I'm really glad to be able to talk about that. Bakersfield is in a unique position where it has its own composting facility for green waste and food waste. Those are other things that are recycled in California. And being in control of that and being very innovative here, according to the state of California, we're the first one to step out and try composting paper that the MRFs are simply unable to sell or move anywhere. And they were beginning to landfill. So it was tragic that we would have people be recycling their paper at home in their blue cart, thinking they're doing the right thing, and then have the MRF end up sadly landfilling it afterwards. So we said, you know, that paper came from trees. We have a process that takes tree trimmings, makes them into soil amendment. Let's merge that. And so far, so good. We've been at it since about July. And we've done some testing. We're happy with it so far. The process works.
Yeah, and so this is the mixed paper you were talking about earlier, correct?
Right, and that's a lot of leftover paper grades. And it even kind of gets to that contamination question. See, the biggest question you have in California about recycling is, what do I do with my pizza box? Is it cardboard or is it trash? Because pizza box has cheese and grease stuck to it. And most recycling places don't want that pizza box in the cardboard because of the cheese and the grease. So they often end up being trash. But being able to take things like that along with the mixed paper to composting, we're actually able to save it from the landfill.
And does it compost easily, these pizza boxes and mixed paper in general?
The paper takes a little bit longer to break down than, say, your normal grass and leaves that we compost every day. But we think it's worthwhile to avoid the landfill.
Now, if this is feasible and composting this material does work, why hasn't it been done already? And why aren't other cities already doing this?
I can't speak for them. I think that some are still hoping to get their stuff clean enough to compete in those few remaining markets. Some places are, we understand, warehousing material. They're storing material, hoping for a market comeback. That's kind of risky. So a lot of different answers there, a lot of factors.
So should Bakersfield residents help you out by starting to put this mixed paper and these pizza boxes, you know, into their green waste bins and kind of save you that extra step?
No, we ask that everyone continue to follow the existing directions, the existing list. Green waste carts in Bakersfield are for green waste only. They're clearly marked that way. We ask that they just stick to that, because if there's a market comeback for the mixed paper, then we don't want people to be being in the wrong can at that point. We don't want to mix up directions. So it's very simple. Just keep following the instructions that are out there.
And when you say market comeback, you mean if there's actually a market for it or a buyer for it that would then be able to turn that paper and, well, basically recycle that paper and turn it back into more paper again, right? That would be ideal.
That's right.
Rather than composting.
Yeah, that's following the principle of the highest and best use for recyclables. It's a very important principle. Paper should ideally be made into paper.
Okay, well, Kevin Barnes from the City of Bakersfield, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Have a good day.
We've looked at how some cities handle waste, but what about you? Do you know what can and can't be recycled? Which bin do you use for your Starbucks cups, your wrapping paper, or your greasy pizza box? Valley Public Radio's Laura Sitsui spoke to the expert behind Fresno's Public Utilities Instagram to find out how she's using social media to appeal to your good sense.
Sitlali Ocampo, you are the outreach coordinator with Fresno's Department of Public Utilities. Thanks for being with us, first of all.
Thank you for having me.
So you have been described as the Instagram guru for the Fresno's for the Department of Public Utilities. But can you explain for listeners who might not be following you on Instagram, what does that mean? What does your job entail?
Okay, so what that exactly means is I am responsible for creating the content that you see when you're sliding through your phone for that account, responding and engaging with followers, just being as active as we can on Instagram and their other platforms to serve and educate residents of Fresno.
And so I know a lot of the ways that could work is people, you mentioned answering questions mm-hmm. and responding. What are some of the common questions that you do get about trash and recycling?
I would say probably our most common question, it's not one specific question in regards to trash and recycling. It's more of can or can I not recycle this? And if I can't, why not? There's a lot of things that residents and myself, even before I started working on this account, thought could be recycled. So you're like you're hoping it can be, and you're like, oh, they'll figure it out. But in reality, sometimes it can't, and things change with that, laws with China and everything. So I would say more of just answering specific items that can and can't be. We've had everything from baby formula containers, yeah, to antifreeze cans. So,
well, I'm glad you mentioned that because I actually wanted to ask you a number of questions about what you can and can't recycle. I've been collecting suggestions from my coworkers. Mm-hmm. And so, first of all, I brought a couple of things. The okay. first is the infamous Starbucks cup. I have a hot one because it's cold outside. Mm-hmm. Is this recyclable? It looks like it's cardboard. I feel like I can, but is it?
Like you just said, an average person would look at it and be like, it's cardboard. I can rinse it out. It's recyclable. I don't believe that is recyclable. And the reason for that is because some of the waxing on the inside plays into how it's broken down in the facility. So our recommendation for that item is for you to actually bring your cup and you get a discount. So you save the planet and you save money. So there's nothing really better than that.
So actually avoid disposable yes. cups if you can. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. What about the cold ones? What about the plastic cups and the straws? And
Same. Yeah. So we actually did a campaign on... We called it hashtag can I recycle this to encourage people to ask us, can I not recycle this? And one of the items was actually the cold Starbucks beverage cup. Mm-hmm. And people were shocked when we said you couldn't because they were like, oh, my God, I've been throwing it in the recycling bin or cart, excuse me, for a really long time. But that also is not, as well as plastic straws. They Ooh. Cannot be, recycled.
Another one that my coworker gave me was her coconut water container, which is like plastic, but also cardboard. And I'm wondering if there are rules about you mentioned like the lining being not mm-hmm. recyclable or hard to probably, take apart. So I don't know. Is this one blue bin acceptable or no?
Sometimes a really good tip is to look at the bottom of the product and it has a number associated with it. So it's probably like 1, 4, 3, 2. I think they go up to 7. It might be even more. We've seen 7. And sometimes products will let you know the material it's made out of to know if it is or isn't recyclable. Mm-hmm. And then you can use that information. If you Google it and you go on to the website, you can figure it out.
One of the things that I was considering, since we are going into this holiday season, is I feel like when you give gifts, you end up giving a lot of trash at the same time.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any tips, or are you planning on, you know, giving any suggestions on how to wrap things without being wasteful, or what do you do with your wrapping paper? Is that recyclable?
Yeah. So we actually did like a holiday highlight that's going to be coming up, and we give tips on the tissue paper and the wrapping paper that you can use, because most of the time, as sucky as it sounds, the really pretty paper that everyone likes, you can't recycle that, right? So we give tips on alternatives that you can also use a scarf to wrap something. Instead of buying like a gift bag, you can carry it in a tote bag that you can continue to use and things like that.
So maybe just having sort of intuitive, like, we're not finding disposable ideas, but maybe reusable and things that last longer than a single use.
Yes.
Even wrapping, not just your coffee beverage.
Yes, exactly.
What do you do with your Christmas tree? Is that like a green bin thing, or what is it?
It is a green bin thing, but you can't throw the entire tree in the cart. You have to, I believe you have to cut it up into 3 feet
long sections.
Thank you. 3 feet long sections to make it easier, obviously, for it to fit in the cart, so it's not a bother to any pedestrians passing by or anything like that, but also it just makes it easier for the city to decompose all of that in.
Interesting. Very cool. Beyond maybe checking out the Instagram, like, what are some of the ways that we can like ask these questions and find out what those rules are? Is there a website that we could be checking a lot?
Yeah. So other than following, it's called the public utilities platforms. Social platforms are called Fresno DPU. So other than following them on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, you can also go online and look up the website. Just type in City of Fresno Public Department of Public Utilities, and within that'll pull up the homepage, and the homepage is broken up into pretty much anything and everything you could think of. From literally, we have a category that's called "Can I recycle this?" or "What is recyclable? What belongs in the green, gray, blue cart?" So that is a really good source of information, and it also offers, we provide the number to call in case you have any questions or you're just curious, you want to get more knowledge on something. We provide that on our social platforms, but you can also get that information from the website. And each division has their specific number to call and ask about specific questions.
I guess what's maybe the overall message that you're trying to convey when you, you know, when people are asking you questions like, can I recycle this? Or is it just about like empowering like Fresno citizens? Mm-hmm. Or what are you guys hoping to accomplish here?
I would say the goal, well, there's a couple goals. First of all, it's to really educate our residents on what can and can't be recycled. Then taking that goal one step further, and what should be placed within each cart. There's three different carts, but there's a lot of confusion as to which items actually belong into which cart. So that would probably be our second objective. And then the third is to really just encourage our residents and to get them. My goal is for them to see a different side of trash and recycles, not just get this out of my sight. It's more of really thinking about what you're holding in your hand, what you could potentially see out on the street, because not everyone throws their trash into the trash cart, right? And to really just show them that there's another alternative. You can still live the life that you want, but you don't have to create as much waste.
All right. Well, we've been speaking with Citlali Ocampo. She's with the City of Fresno's Department of Public Utilities marketing team, and part of that includes running their social media and helping them get that message out. And you can find her and their work through their Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Fresno DPU. So, Lolly, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Of course, before cities decide what to do with waste, it has to be picked up. Well, in San Diego, people who are homeless and living in a downtown transitional shelter called The Bridge get paid to pick up litter. I spoke with Amy Gagno, Chief Operating Officer for the ELFA Project, a homeless advocacy organization. It oversees the litter project, called Wheels of Change.
Now, a teenager helped to start Wheels of Change. Can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of his mission?
Sure. Kevin Barber and his mother, Carolyn Barber, had gone to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and had saw a program similar to Wheels of Change and wanted to come back and try to implement it locally here. And they came to Alpha Project and started it with a donation of $50,000 to purchase a van that we could go out and pick up litter, needles, everything you can imagine. So trash pickup around the community.
So his mother, who's an ER doctor, helped to fund the 6-month pilot program. And now does the city fund it, or who funds it?
Now the city has stepped up to fund, you know, the hard costs. So vehicle maintenance, gas, vest, pickup sticks, you know, insurance, all the hard costs. The other component is that we pay the minimum wage 3 days a week. They go out for 4 hours. These are people that reside at our 324-bed bridge shelter that's located downtown San Diego. And we select 10 to 12 people each time we go out. So for that component, because it's a stipend, that with federal funding cannot pay for. So that's the piece that makes it a little more challenging. We have to fundraise donations around that amount of money.
So donations pay for it's minimum wage, correct?
Yeah, they're not employees of ours, so it gets tricky when it comes to any kind of, you know, federal, local funding from the city or our housing authority or things like that. So it's just that's the one category that you really have to fundraise around.
But in terms of the cost, how does it compare to, say, hiring a private company or even Caltrans to come in and clean up an area?
There's no payroll taxes. There's no, you know, I mean, there's not that layer of additional funding. And we're only paying minimum wage. So they make $46 a day. So if you had a Caltrans or something like that, I mean, I can't even imagine how much that cost would increase. And the bottom line is this is giving people that are experiencing homelessness, you know, an opportunity to make a little bit of money.
So the community reaction initially was not positive, but it's turned around?
So when we went to put up the bridge shelter in the area we were in, of course, nobody wants a homeless shelter in their backyard, right? So you always have to fight for it and the community, you know, impact, and you have to be really careful of that kind of thing. So at first, of course, like any homeless provider goes through, understandably, no one wants that in their backyard. So now they're being able to see them out in their community, cleaning their community up for free. And so, you know, now community members are driving by, honking their horns, waving at people. One guy even stopped and gave everybody a $10 bill one day, and they're just like, they cheer at them now. So it's so empowering for the people that are participating in the program. It just builds their self-esteem, confidence, gives them some money to buy. Some people have bought birth certificates, IDs, clothes for an interview, got their hair cut, things like that.
I would imagine it boosts self-esteem in that homeless people typically feel invisible in our society, and now they're getting positive feedback.
Absolutely. We've already picked up 20 tons of garbage.
And how do you know you've picked up 20 tons of garbage?
We do a partnership with what's called in San Diego the Downtown Partnership, and they have a clean and safe program, and they have a huge waste management truck. And because they're very good partners of ours, they go around and follow us and pick up all the trash. That's the other cost savings if you had like a private person doing it. Like, so we don't pay any dump fees. We don't have to have some huge truck because we're in their boundary area where they pick up anyway. So we're actually helping them do their jobs, and they're helping us do our program.
Now tell me, how do you choose the people who are going to go out on any given day?
Well, yeah, that's a good question because we have about 150 or so people that really want to participate. But if they're doing well in the program, if they're following, you know, the rules, if they're, you know, participating in case management or receiving all the on-site services that we have on there. So we kind of evaluate it on what are your goals and what are your outcomes, and we're going to give you a shot first. We rotate all the time, so it's not the same people going out every time we go out. So everybody gets an opportunity at some point to go out on the crew. Because it's been so successful, we're now expanding to a second van to do even more.
And some people are homeless because of PTSD or addiction issues. Do these come up? And if so, how do you tackle them?
No, we have not had one issue in regards to that. If we did, you know, we would handle it because the people that are supervising them are our staff who have that training, who can do that. If they were acting out, which has not happened once, we could always, you know, drive them back to the shelter. people are so encouraging to them. You know, the community is so encouraging to them. So it's like the spirit lifter where they're like, I am somebody. I can contribute. I can contribute to the solution rather than the problem. And some people have even come back and said, I'm never littering again because this is not okay. You know, things like that, those little anecdotal things that people come back and say is just, it's a really cool experience to see.
So they're becoming role models or mentors for other people.
They are. And the other cool component that we added to this project, which no, the other projects did not have, is that we have a peer-to-peer outreach component. So we're having those homeless individuals talk to other homeless individuals as they, you know, see them and encourage them to access services, get into shelters. This is my experience. And so it's a really unique aspect in terms of a different approach to homeless outreach.
So how many people would you say have been affected by this in the homeless community, or how many people have been able to participate in this program?
Over 300. We didn't start till March of this year, and we started out as a pilot. So we're only going out like once a week just to kind of feel it out and get moving forward and things like that. And then we expanded probably in April or May, going the 3 days a week for the 4 hours. And so we've been able to serve 300 different people through the program so far.
And now you'll have 2 vans 3 days a week.
Yes, exactly. Now we're going to be able to double it.
And did you use other cities outside of California as a model?
You know, Carolyn and Kevin had seen a similar project in Albuquerque. Now what they did, and this is not what we're doing with it, is they would take people out that are actually street homeless. We wanted to focus on our bridge shelter population because at the end of the day, they're going back to shelter. We can watch them. We can say, what are you doing with your cash? You know what I mean? And they're stable in housing.
And how many people live there?
325.
Okay. And so 325 people live there, and you said 300 have already had the opportunity. Does that mean a big chunk of the people coming in and out of there get to do this or choose to do this?
Yeah, because, you know, since it is a bridge shelter, we're placing people into housing and other longer term housing or permanent housing, or sometimes people just choose to leave right on their own. So we've served a lot more people than 325.
So what is the cost to the city?
The cost to the city right now is $125,000.
For a year or for, what do you mean?
Yes, for a year.
Okay. Is there someone who comes to mind when you're thinking about this program who really benefited from it?
Oh my God, there's so many success stories with this one. One person was able to buy some clothes, get a haircut, go to a job interview, you know, and actually get the job. And we've gotten some people actually into our bridge shelter due to the peer-to-peer outreach component that we've put in.
I'm sure as the project ramps up, you will have many more stories to tell. You said there's also a Facebook site that people can go to. I've been speaking with Amy Gagno, Chief Operating Officer of the ELFA Project, which oversees Wheels of Change. Thanks again, Amy.
Thank you for having me.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at KVPR.
Did you know we have an app? It's called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Carrie Klein, and reporters Laura Sitsui and Monica Velez. Our audio engineer is Marv Allen, and Don Weaver is our production and operations manager. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.